I moved to Switzerland, where I now inhabit an old chateau from the 13th century, situated in the magnificent Canton de Valais, just above Sierre, in a landscape that reminds one of Spain and Provence, in complete solitude, occupied with my work and the roses in my little garden. There's a letter which Rainer Maria Rilke wrote to Marina Tsvetaeva on May 17th, 2026, from the sanatorium he was living in at the time in Valmont in Switzerland, about 2 hours from Chateau Musot. I am currently in this area in Venthon, which looks down onto the town where Musot resides. Yesterday, I saw the chateau and its beautiful vineyards around it and went to the Rilke Foundation's house in the town and had a really lovely time, being completely unable to communicate with the woman who worked there. But we had a nice gesturing session and walking around looking at the posters and poems that they had up on the walls, and just is sort of like a walking tour through his time in the area in Musot and through his poems and themes in his poems. And I'll speak a little bit to that later. Seeing his razor blade and his little Bible and his perfume and his ink pot was delightful, as well as a beautiful embroidered blanket which he used when he was at Musot. So as I sit here in this room, looking out of this tiny window at the same mountains that Rilke stared at when he spent such a beautiful and extremely lonely, as he would have it, time of great solitude in the ultimate and utmost state, for formerly being alone in Paris and Rome and Venice, where I've spent much of my time without being alone, he says. Musot, on the other hand, more challenging than anything else, allowed nothing but achievement, the vertical leap out into open space, the whole earth's ascension to heaven within me. This is in his letter to Marina. And looking out now at these vertical spaces, so much air here, so much more air, while these massive mountains take up so much space. I was staring out from a field across at the Alps across from me, and the snow on some, the sliding dirt on others, and all the trees. And there was this hawk circling in the air, and I just thought, what a place to be a hawk, looking down to know the landscape so well. The birds here are incredible. There's just so many species of birds, and some really different ones. I've never seen this one. I gotta look it up. It's huge, like a crow, but it's black and white. And when it flutters around, it really is like angels are coming, because the wings are so loud. And it's always with its mate. There's always two, at least. And then when I was sitting in this field on this path I found, I saw these little tiny butterflies that were checkered black and white. And they were so beautiful, and they were like that bird, but tiny. I mean, in color, I should say. And they were just lazing around in this field of wildflowers, and also often in pairs. And it's so magnificent to see such black and white checkered delicacy lighting on these just bright purple flowers that looked like chives. They look like the blossoming of a chive, but I'm not sure what flower it is. I will also be looking up that flower. I wanted to not wax on about my time in the field because I'm a hopeless romantic in these sorts of situations like some other poets we're honoring today, but I'm going to read this excerpt from this letter to Marina Tsvetaeva, and it's really been incredible reading this New York Review Books classic between Boris Pasternak, Tsvetaeva, and Rilke in the summer of 26, which he was living in this area but was too sick with his blood cancer, his cancer of the blood, which he had, I'm not sure how far along the diagnosis was. But he was in the sanatorium at the time. But he talks much of his stay here, and as they exchange poems and gush over one another, I feel much, my heart is full thinking of their love for each other, just via words, just via language and poems. I hadn't even met in person any of them. So I'll be reading partly through this letter to Marina, starting about halfway through, and he's talking about the elegies. These poems had begun 1912 in no less grand a solitude on the Adriatic, in the old, destroyed by the war, castle of Duino near Trieste. In Spain and later in Paris, fragments of lines turned up, and all of this would probably have converged into achievement in 1914 in Paris, if that great interruption of the world had not cut in, making me so rigid and static for years. Whatever I might have saved out of that long winter of my being, I myself did not know when I was finally, 1919, able to take refuge in Switzerland as on a soil where something natural and guileless still had full authority. I did not find it out until 1921, after Musat, in the first lonely year I was in residence there, when the nature of my temperament, which circumstances had repressed, drove, within a few weeks, the unheard-of growth, first of Orpheus, each part in 3 days, then of the elegies, into its season of completion, violently, almost destroying me with the passion of its outbreak, and yet acting so gently and with such a sense of pattern that not one, think of it, not a single pre-existing line failed to be fitted into the place in which it was a natural stare and a voice among the voices. How that healed together, the earlier with its already aging fracture surface so intimately fitted into the glowing one, taking on such a new glow from proximity and infinite kinship that never a visible seam remained. Triumph and jubilation, Marina, without equal. And this is what the overabundance of solitude in all its deadliness was needed for. But then was it that I tried to maintain the impossible conditions of intensified isolation over and beyond what had been achieved, mastered? This I did not from stubbornness or to wrest a bonus from grace, but because letting in the, quote, other, living by him and for him, instantly, or just after the instant, entails conflict and tasks I had to fear at a time when I had accomplished everything, much too extremely, merely to change to a new kind of achievement? Or is it, since the work itself, our great breathing labor, does not take refuge after all, even when it forces us outside and beyond ourselves, it leaves us not fatigued or exhausted, but staggering under the reward. It is that, mechanically, I endured too long the same special conditions of seclusion in a heroic valleyscape under the almost sun-raging sky of a wine country, at any rate, for the first time in my life and in a treacherous fashion. My own aloneness turned against me with a physical sting, rendering this being with myself suspect and dangerous, and more threatening because of the physical disturbances that now drowned out what to me had been forever and ever the most primeval silence. Hence, my presence here in Valmont for the third time now, after two shorter stays in 1924 and 1925, hence my long sojourn in Paris, January to mid-August 1925, where in all conscience the opposite, the adversary of the life offered by Musot, seemed to gain entry in all its guises and permutations. Hence my reluctance to withdraw once more into my solid tower with all the danger that had invaded me and was rankly growing inside me. What do the doctors think? A trauma of the nerve, which they call grand sympathique, that large, beautiful tree of nerves, which, if it does not bear our fruits, at any rate, possibly bring forth the most dazzling blossom of our being. Disturbances of a more subjective than really factually or organically discernible kind, so far at any rate. Inroads upon the absence of bodily self-awareness, from which harmony with our material stake in ourselves so involuntarily results. Slight disorders of my body which render me all the more at a loss since I have been used to living with it, in so perfect a concord without a physician that I was close to thinking of it as a child of my soul. This began at a certain turning point in my life, about 1899 and 1900, which coincided with my residence in Russia. Light and handy as it was, and easy to take along into the most abstract spheres, how often voided, endowed with weight only by courtesy, and still visible merely so as not to alarm the invisible. So intimately mine, friend, truly my bearer, the holder of my heart, capable of all my joys, disparaging none, making each my own in a more particular way, bestowing them upon me at the precise intersection of my senses. As my creature, ready for me, and risen in service to my use, as pre-creature, outweighing me, with all the security and magnificence of descent, a thing of genius, reared by centuries, glorious in the serene innocence of its not-I, touching in its eagerness to be faithful to the I, all its transitions and oscillations, simple of mind and wise. How much I have to thank it, which, by dint of its nature, reinforced my delight in a fruit, in the wind, in walking on grass. To thank it, whereby I am akin to the impenetrable into which I cannot force entry, and to the fluid element that runs off me. And it was still conversant with the stars by virtue of its heaviness. To sum up, distressing this dissension with it, and too fresh a distress to be ready for compromise yet. And the doctor cannot understand what it is that distresses me so profoundly, so centrally, about these handicaps, which after all are tolerable, although they have set up their branch offices all over the body, while they were about it. it's so beautiful to hear these words about the body itself. Of course, the moment we think we're losing something, the moment we are no longer in the routine with the thing, a slight but vast alteration of our orientation towards it, even being within the thing. I mean, Rilke in his body, me in mine here, the proximity to these places he was, this slight reorientation, a disturbance in the familiar idea of it. It's like the fantasy of it that we take for granted, right? We take the body for granted as it is. To suddenly see is a child of our soul, the body, a child of our soul. Just as I imagined the body of this place, now that I'm here, I do feel a kind of pain, but there's that sweetness that I see Rilke coming to in delighting in the body as it becomes more painful. This is why maybe we have to suffer, that being is suffering, not in a masochistic way of liking pain, but just that pain is. I feel all this pressure to be happy. I fantasize about being somebody who approaches everything with a light heart, and maybe someday I will. I think it's good to aspire to. But I can't think of this heaviness either, even the heaviness of the body, as being something bad that I have to keep trying to fix and to cure. How can you fix a threshold? That's all the heaviness is, walking through doors. There was this exhilaration I felt walking through the doors of the Rilke Museum. I'd feel that so much, I think, walking into Duino or to Musat, but they're both privately owned and you can't walk into them. That in itself is a perfect metaphor for what one has to face. The distance of something you can't enter eternally, it seems everything. Even watching the bees enter the flowers, when I sat in the field, I thought just of what I think Rilke even seemed to touch upon in this letter. Rilke speaks of conflicts of letting in the, quote, other living by him and for him instantly, or just after the instant, entails conflicts and tasks that I had to fear at a time when I had accomplished everything. His longing for solitude, I'm gathering from what he says about my own aloneness turned against me with a physical sting, rendering this being with myself suspect and dangerous, and more threatening because of the physical disturbances that now drowned out what to me had been forever and ever the most primeval silence, hence my presence here at Valmont. That somehow his aloneness caused his blood disease, or that he thought that that was what was so painful inside his body at that moment. Today I'm gonna go to Rilke's grave. It's sort of a hard place to get to when you don't have a car, but it will be like all my little treks on this trip, my own journey. There's been so much solitude on this leg of the trip. just because I needed to write and whatever, but also just, I don't speak French, and it's hard for me to talk to people when I don't know anybody. I don't know. I guess I'm very shy. This is new. This is okay. Maybe today I'll try to sit down and talk to somebody at a cafe. I'm very much reading over and over again the final sonnet in the sonnet cycle. It's completely ridiculous of me to be sharing this with you. I should be starting from the beginning, but there's just too much. Rilke finished the sonnets on a whirlwind here. He finished the elegies finally. A sort of cycle was completing itself in him. I have much to say on the contents of the sonnets and the elegies, obviously, the eternal podcast on the subject. And I have to say, too, that at the Rilke Museum, there wasn't a ton there, but they had a library of books, Rilke books on Rilke, by Rilke, in different editions of his books. And it was just staggering amount of books on Rilke and editions of his books and his poems and his prose. Just incredible how many people have interacted with him, and in all different languages. And it was so beautiful to see. And you know, you feel this intimacy with someone like Rilke that Tessa Vadieva talks about in one of her really great letters that I just read as well, when she says, by Rilke the man, I mean the one who lives, who gets things published, who must be tired by now of so much love. By Rilke the man, I meant the place where there is no room for me. Thus the entire set of poet and man. Renunciation, abnegation, lest you might think that I am intruding into your life. She merely was humbling herself, saying that she loved the poet because she didn't feel that the man had any room for her. Which, you know, with the amount of people that loved Rilke, and in his family even, right? He barely knew his daughter or his granddaughter. That there was such a huge sacrifice in proximity to people you love in the life he chose. And as a poet and a person who longs and loves and wants to be with, I understand this conflict between wanting to be alone and devoted to the words and then wanting to be within the domestic sphere of one's life. But it was interesting to read Tessa Vadieva's letters about her own life and her children and her husband. So sad to think about how it ended for her with her husband's execution, her daughter's arrest, and her suicide. That sort of hangs in the background here. So much sorrow behind all our words. These words are so full of passion and excitement to be engaging. And I think that's where I want my heart to dwell right now, is the sort of the joy and the engagement of the letter itself and in the poems themselves, which are the real letters. But this is my letter to you in parting. This final sonnet by Rilke in the Sonnets to Orpheus. And I'm going to add an audio recording of the landscape that I took when I was sitting in the field and contemplating the bees and the flowers. Sonnet 29. translated by Stephen Mitchell. Silent friend of many distances, feel how your breath enlarges all of space. Let your presence ring out like a bell into the night. What feeds upon your face grows mighty from the nourishment thus offered. Move through transformation, out and in. What is the deepest loss that you have suffered? If drinking is bitter, change yourself to wine. In this immeasurable darkness, be the power that rounds your senses in their magic ring, the sense of their mysterious encounter. And if the earthly no longer knows your name, whisper to the silent earth, I am flowing. To the flashing water, say, I am flowing.